Whenever I visit France, I always see lots of top bottles for sale, but when I get back home, those same bottles can be much harder to find, if not impossible. That's why I use idealwine.com. At idealwine.com, I can buy wines directly from France for delivery directly to my home. They have new auctions every week, and the fixed price selection is equally awesome. Clos Vougeard, Chateau Reyes, and Ulysse Collan, as well as many more greats from all over France, are regularly available on the website. Best of all, it is simple and hassle-free to buy them. Ideal Wine handles all the customs and logistics hurdles for you and for me. Wines are ordered with a couple of clicks, and then they arrive. It is simple. Check out idealwine.com for more information. That's IDEALWINE.com to find what you'd like to be drinking.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. You are not the type of guy that would be in a place like this at this time in the morning, Jay McInerney.
But here you are.
But here you are at the podcast.
Yeah. Well, it's good to be here, and I love to talk about food, wine, writing.
Which of those came first for you?
Well, I suppose I was a writer before I was a writer about wine, and in fact, it never occurred to me that I would or could write about wine. But in 1996, a friend of mine took over House and Garden as the editor-in-chief. And she felt like the kind of consumer that she was after was interested in food and wine as part of the good life. And she did some research, and she really didn't like, as a wine lover, she didn't like what she read about wine. She didn't like the sort of, you know, Wine Spectator kind of technical / travelogue approach, and she didn't like the, you know, the sort of English this wine smells like hibiscus approach, and she just felt like there wasn't much out there that spoke to her, and so she conceived this idea of getting a writer to write about wine as opposed to a wine expert. And when she first approached me, I said that, you know, I just don't know nearly enough about wine to write about it. And she felt that could be a strength if, you know, particularly if I admitted that I didn't really know what malolactic fermentation was. She also knew that I was incredibly passionate about wine. That was why she approached me.
Like, in fact, you liked wine.
She had been to my dinner parties, and yeah. I mean, I more than liked wine. I collected it. I read about it. I spent a lot of time poring over wine catalogs. So when I say I didn't know enough, I just meant that it seemed to me you had to know everything if you were going to write about wine. And she said, no, I mean, why should you have to know everything? Why don't you just sort of, you know, why don't you write as if you're one chapter ahead of in the textbook, and admit it when you're learning something new. But she just felt really that most wine writing was pretty boring, and that there had to be a way around that. And maybe, you know, approaching someone who was adept at using metaphors and similes and writing about characters was a way to make wine writing a little more interesting, at least to her, and presumably to her readers. And so, you know, I said I'd try it for 6 months, and it turns out I'm still doing it today. Although House and Garden folded in 2007, it was in the advance guard of the of the magazine's closing, and so I took a 3-year hiatus, and then the Wall Street Journal approached me in 2010.
But there had been a publication of your short work from House and Garden in a book form in the meantime.
I published two wine books that collected my essays about wine. Well, the essays is a little bit grandiose. They were columns, but someone from a small press approached me about 3 or 4 years after I started the wine column, and they wanted to collect the columns. And so I had to approach my own publisher, the publisher of my fiction, which was Alfred A. Knopf, and say, do you guys mind? Do you want to do it yourselves? And And they sort of said, "Oh, no problem. You go right ahead and publish your little wine book." And actually sold extremely well.
Bacchus and Me, the first one.
Bacchus and Me, yeah. So that as it turned out, they were quite happy to do the next one, which was called A Hedonist in the Cellar. And it just became, I mean, I guess inevitably I learned a lot more about wine because thanks to Condé Nast's rather lavish expense account, I was, you know, traveling around the world, visiting winemakers, learning about wine, tasting wine. It was a great education. I mean, it was the best way to get a wine education. You know, you like Didier Dagenaud, go visit him, you know? And I sort of made it a rule that I didn't write about anything that I hadn't seen. I didn't want to do those pieces that were based on having lunch with somebody in New York, you know? I mean, I wanted to see what the land looked like and what the soil looked like and what the, you know, I mean, not so much the cellar, because cellars can be pretty
cold,
pretty uniform and cold. But, and you know, to meet the people and hang with them. And I think part of my approach was always to write about the people who make wine. You know, they're a pretty interesting tribe. And
what do you think about those?
Oh, I think they're a very interesting crew. You know, they really fall, there's two broad categories, I think. You know, there are those, particularly in Europe, who inherited family domains, who decided to continue the tradition. In the New World, the story of a wine domain is usually the story of somebody who's incredibly successful in some other area of life, who loves wine, and then goes and reinvents himself or herself as a winery owner or even a winemaker. And those are always good stories. You know, I mean, everybody in Napa fits in that category. A lot of people in Sonoma. And it's really interesting to consider the connection of personality and the finished product of the wine. Although, as a guy with an old world palate, I think maybe terroir often trumps the the personality of the winemaker. But, you know, it's very tempting to say that Francois Ravineau is kind of an austere guy and he makes austere wines. And, you know, and I think probably I was a little bit too prone to that type of thinking when I first started writing about wine. But, you know, that's part of the learning process.
What did those winemakers think about you? I mean, you have some experience, right, with self-invention, self-reinvention.
Well, you know, a lot of them know who I am from another world. And I think initially there was a lot of surprise every time I called up or showed up. What's this novelist doing in my cellar? But eventually, by the time I started writing for the journal, it was pretty well known that I was writing about wine.
They stopped making the cocaine jokes. What's this one smell like, Jay? Cocaine?
Well, yeah, well, that was the food editor of House and Garden was violently opposed to me being the wine writer because she felt that I couldn't possibly have a nose left. And so I had to convince her. I had to win her over, which I eventually did, although unfortunately I showed up at lunch at the Four Seasons the first time we met after like an all-nighter with Bret Easton Ellis. And I was not showing my best, as we say, about certain wines.
But did you guys, you and Bret, used to hang in real life? Because you were kind of lumped together by the press when you came up as a novelist.
Yeah, we became really good friends. A friend of mine named Morgan Entrekin told me shortly after Bright Lights came out that he was publishing a book set in Los Angeles, and he was going to promote it as the West Coast version of Bright Lights, Big City. And in the meantime, I was on a panel with Bret, who sort of, you know, became very talked about even before the book came out because he was very young. And, you know, the book was fairly, the subject matter was fairly sensational. And basically, I was just going through the whole ringer of, you know, the press and the good and bad and the rewards and the drawbacks of writing a novel that is judged to be a sort of zeitgeist document. And I could see that it was the same thing was going to happen to him. And so I just kind of befriended him. I remember the first time we went out together, we went to Indochine, like virtually the night that it opened. And then we went to the MTV Music Awards together. It sounds very McInerney Ellis, doesn't it? we became really good friends, and we would. Whenever we were both in town, we would always have a Friday night dinner. And sometimes the dinner lasted till Saturday morning, which
was, I think, the case the first time that I met Laura Zerubin, the food editor of House and Garden. As I said, we eventually became great friends and traveled. We traveled all around the world together. I think she somehow convinced them that I wasn't capable of escorting myself around the world. And so she got to go on all these trips. She actually has a great palate. She knows a lot about wine. But we had these great adventures together. Laura's gay, so...
Well, so is Brett.
It was, yes, but in other words, it was, you know, it was.
You weren't shacking up on the way.
Yeah, it was an interesting.
Your wife shouldn't get upset about this story.
Yes, my various wives over the years didn't worry too much about this, but we were, you know, we were a comedy act, really. I mean, we got arrested together. You know, we got lost in the back roads in Italy, screaming at each other that, you know, about whose fault it was. I mean, she wouldn't let me drive because she hated my driving. So I was the navigator. And then she would like fend off waitresses and stuff. It was weird for somebody who's gay. She really managed to get between me and and an awful lot of women. But it was a great adventure for, I don't know, 10 or 11 years. And, I never thought that, you know, this would become part of my life. It was always a diversion, or for a while I thought of it as a diversion, and now it's a great part of my life. I love being in the wine world. I love the people.
But originally, it was just something you did to kind of like break your mind out of the novel thing.
It was just a kind of an adventure. You know, a diversion. I really didn't think I would stick with it, but it seems I have. it's been about 19 years now.
But if I was really celebrated for being a novelist, which you were, I might find it kind of a relief to do something where the pressure was off.
Honestly, it was. It really was, because you know, sitting down to write a novel is a really daunting task, and writing a 1,200 word wine column is not nearly so daunting, and also the focus isn't on me. You know, I like getting outside as a fiction writer. You, in some way, you're pulling a lot of it out of yourself, and you're always starting from scratch in a way. Whereas, you know, journalism of any kind, at least you've got the subject matter. You know, you've got the donné, the given, and you know, I do other types of journalism as well.
You wanted to be a journalist originally. Like you went to school and you were like, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I always wanted to be a novelist, but it seemed that journalism was a way to go. I never really wanted to do the teaching thing. Most American fiction writers teach English at colleges or high schools or universities, and it's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. But I didn't feel like I wanted to be in the university. I got my master's degree and that was it. Then I wanted to be out in the world. And, you know, writing about wine or about a trial or anything else, it gets you out of the apartment and out of your own head in a way that I found to be a great relief after sort of 10, 11 years of just writing fiction and having everybody watching me very closely, you know.
Because you were in the Scorpion
My first jar. Book was extremely successful. And after that, there wasn't a lot of room for just playing, for flubs, for, you know, screwing around, for mistakes, for, I felt really, really scrutinized as a novelist. And
Some people gave you a hard time, right?
Writing, oh, God, yeah, yeah, no, I got
It wasn't of, like everyone was like, this guy's amazing.
Well, the more amazing you are in the beginning, the more rapidly some people feel the need to supply the necessary corrective backlash, I think. But, you know, I was also, you know, I was living in New York City. I was living a very visible life as a guy who went out at night, and suddenly there were, you know, there were photographers around, and suddenly there were reporters around writing down what I said, writing down some version of what I said. And, you know, all of that created a kind of persona that, you know, it was based in reality, but it was also terribly exaggerated, and where I really just wanted to escape all of that. And writing about wine was a way to escape. It was a way to, you know, in the first few years I was writing about wine, I mean, very few people even noticed it, you know? And that was fine with me. I kind of wanted to go under the radar. Well, particularly in the beginning, because as I say, I was not terribly confident about my wine knowledge. I wasn't Robert Parker. I wasn't Jancis Robinson. There was no question, and nor would I ever be. So I was okay with me that even a lot of people in the wine world had no idea I was writing about wine.
But you had a literary cachet that they'll never have, right? You had this expertise in this other field.
Well, I was lucky because that did open a lot of doors for me. I mean, you know, I think that there were places that I went that the House and Garden card wouldn't have opened the door, and the Jay McInerney card did. So I benefited from that. But I really, you know, I really wanted it to be kind of a low-key sideline. I didn't want to be Mr. Wine. I didn't want to be the best wine writer in the world. I just wanted to be part of it, you know. And I found the community very welcoming. I mean, the more that people did get to know me as someone who wrote about wine, the more I felt like I was welcomed, you know. The literary world can be incredibly exclusive and bitchy. And, you know, the joke in the writing world is, you know, nobody is bitchier than poets because the rewards are so, you know, there's such a limited pool of rewards. And, you know, they're fighting for much smaller scraps than, say, filmmakers are, or novelists even for that matter. But likewise with novelists, you know, it's a pretty competitive field. There's not as much community as one might hope. I mean, you know, I certainly have my very good friends who are writers, but it's not like the food and wine world where, you know, it's a very large club. And I felt very...
But it is a club. They're both kinds of clubs, right?
They're both kinds of clubs. But the wine world, which we can't really separate from the food world, I think is much more inclusive, much more welcoming than, at least I found it that way.
But you know, like clubs, right? Like food, you're attracted to clubs. I mean, right? Like social sets,
well,
right?
Yes,
you like
but
that.
But I like them to be inclusive, you know? And I just think, you know, the people who make wine are among the happier people in the world. They tend to live in incredibly beautiful places. They tend to be buzzed half the time. They tend to eat really well and travel around the world, you know? I mean, it's a good life. And, you know, I think I just felt very glad to be part of it.
You know, and I think that really comes through, especially in the early wine writing, because as opposed to the novels that you wrote, the wine writing is really enthusiastic and happy and like joyful. And the,
yeah.
And the novels are kind of like disappointed, sad, apprehensive. We just lost something that was important to us. I don't know. What do you do to have fun? I'm not sure.
Well, a lot of people find Bright Lights, Big City to be a comedy. I don't know. But
do they really? Yeah. Is that just because Michael Fox is in the movie? Or?
Oh, God. Michael Fox is an afterthought. But I mean, Bright Lights is, in many respects, a comic novel.
Did you mean it that way?
I mean, when I read parts of Bright Lights, audiences, they laugh.
Okay. Because Bret Easton Ellis had the same problem with American Psycho.
You got to go back and look at it because it's Bright Lights is a comedy more than anything, I think.
About embarrassment, right?
Well, like embarrassment can be funny. but you're right that my wine writing certainly had a different tone. You know, I write about wine as a lover and not as a fighter, not as a critic, really, you know? And there's a lot of shitty wine out there, and you know what? I just don't write about it. And I'm really grateful to people like Robert Parker and Antonio Galloni and Steven Tanzer who, you know, who just taste everything and judge it and write about it. But I kind of, I just write about the things that I really like that make me enthusiastic, make me happy, make me, you know, want to whoop and have sex and party on. And so I guess you're right. There's a different tone in the wine writing. It's one of appreciation, and it's one of passion and enthusiasm.
Who were some of the first people on the wine side that you're like, yeah, this person, this is a thing?
You know, I was inspired. I mean, Angelo Gaia is a friend of mine. He was one of the first people I met as a wine writer. It was funny for a while. I was close with Helen Turley and John Wetlaufer, who have since fallen out of my life. I think I got excommunicated like many people. I'm not sure why. But I learned
there was never a note or anything. No,
but I learned a lot about wine from those guys, and I had some very very good times with them. Bruno Bury of Ducru Beaucaillou became a very close friend of mine, and he's in addition to wine, we love a lot. You know, we have a lot of other passionate interests.
He likes to cook.
He cooks. He's an art collector. He has some of the best Keith Herrings I've ever seen. I mean, aside from a whole lot of other stuff. Yes, he's a bon vivant, let's say. And, you know, I learned from these guys. I actually, I learned a lot from Bob Parker. And then I, you know, with great trepidation, I called up and said, you know, could I write about a column about you? And he said, come on down. Imagine meeting Robert Parker in 1996. I mean,
at the height of his thing.
Yeah, man. I mean, he's, you know, he was the man. And as I said, a lot of what I knew, I'd learned from reading his The Wine Advocate, you know, and but it was great. We went to lunch. It was just the two of us, and we drank like three bottles of wine.
Is he a big eater? He eats a lot.
He's a huge eater. Yeah, he's a huge eater. In fact, he told me the story himself about it. He went to Charlie Trotter's in Chicago in the early days. I think I had just been, so we were talking about it. And he said, "Oh, I love Charlie Trotter's. He's great." He said the only thing is that I did the tasting menu, and it's like 16 courses. And he said, I was still hungry, so I went to Wienertown and had three dogs. And you know, that's Parker. You know, one of the things that I really liked about Parker and that I still admire is that he's a hedonist, you know. I mean, I know certain wine writers and critics who sort of like, you know, sort of spit and dump and you know, at the end of the night, you figure you're like, they've maybe had two-thirds of a glass of wine in the course of several hours. And you know what? I don't trust those people. I don't trust anybody who isn't a hedonist on the subject of food and wine.
It's like Sydney Greenstreet here, you know, from Maltese Falcon. It's like, well done, sir. I don't trust the man who doesn't drink.
Yeah. Well, I don't. And, you know, but Parker is like, you know, I'd see him at Danielle. In the early days when Danielle had his first restaurant, and I briefly lived on the Upper East Side, right next door virtually to Danielle. And, you know, this was before I knew him or was writing about wine. I'd see this guy, you know, be a table of three or four people and like 16 bottles of wine. And it was, I don't know, it was kind of impressive. But, you know, I still think he was a tremendous force for good and for education in early American wine scene. And by early, I mean, you know, the 80s. I mean, really all of this culture that we are now part of, you and me and so many other people, you know, it didn't really exist before The Wine Advocate came along and before the 1982 Bordeaux vintage and the sort of the cult of the chef arose more or less at the same time. But we didn't have that. You know, when Montrachet opened in 1985, or Union Square Cafe, you know, a sommelier was like a cranky, you know, cranky fat French guy in a tuxedo with an ashtray around his neck. And fine dining meant, you know, very stiff, formal French dining. It was a whole different world. And wine pretty much meant Bordeaux. And it pretty much, you know, we all just accepted the 1855 classification and we drank whatever vintage came along, and it all changed. In the years that I wrote, published Bright Lights of Big City, and subsequently, it seems to me it coincided with, you know, a tremendous flowering of interest in wine in this country. And suddenly, there was a wine culture. And I think Parker deserves credit for a lot of that.
I mean, it's funny that you phrase it that way, because a lot of times what I think of as your real subject, beyond anything else, beyond New York or certain social sets, is transformation. This mm-hmm. is a thing or a person that's about to move from this to
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And I see you, when you structure articles about wine, you structure it often in the same way. Like, this is what's going to change. This is happening. You know what I mean? It's all, I see very often here that you focus in on the change moment. And you've been around for some. You've been around for some changes.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the big change is there's certainly been a democratization of wine knowledge and of wine writing. And to me, the big shift in the last 5 years or so has been a sommelier culture has sort of become, it has replaced to some extent the critics. That is to say, There is a there's now a community of sommeliers around the country. Every major city has a community of sommeliers, and they are educating people about wine and influencing how wine is made as much as anybody else. You know, I mean, I think we've never been so inundated with wine information and opinion, and there's room for a lot of schools out there. You know, some people love big, fleshy Napa Cabernets with cleavage, you know, and, you know, my heart is in the leaner, more elegant, less ripe style, I suppose. But you know, I think there's room at the table for a lot of styles.
I mean, I think that that is the insight that people of, how should I say, your generation have, that sometimes the younger writers don't. It seems like some of the younger writers are more like, this is what it is. And the people who've seen this thing change once or twice are like, yeah, well, it's a big world.
Well, you know, if I leave myself in the hands of a sommelier in Brooklyn, I can pretty much predict that I'll get an orange wine from, you know, it's going to be something really different and kind of new, and something that your father's sommelier wouldn't have ever even heard of.
And how does that make you feel? Because you chronicled sommeliers from the beginning. One of your first articles was on Jean-Luc.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, I like learning. So when I go to a restaurant, you know, that has a sommelier, I often kind of say, hey, I'd love to see something new and different. And a lot of what I've learned about wine has been from sommeliers. I you know, they're on the front lines. Even though I write about wine, I'm still a full-time novelist, and I can't taste 40 wines a day. You know, I drink two or three a day, but I'm not always out there tasting. And sommeliers more and more have become the educators of this generation of wine drinkers. And I had my own small patch of knowledge, which was partly shaped by my friends in London. You know, when I published Bright Light, I went to London. I met a lot of guys like Martin Amis and Ian McEwan and Salman Rushdie, but the
bad boys of the British side, because those are all kind of bad boys, and you're kind of the bad boy of this side, right?
But oddly enough, the one I bonded with was Julian Barnes, who's not a bad boy. You know, I mean, he's Apollo to my Dionysus, but we really hit it off. And one of the reasons we did was because he was really into wine, and he invited me. We met at this big literary dinner, but he asked me if I had any nights free while I was in London, and he invited me over to his house a couple of days later, and he had a real wine cellar, which I thought was really cool. And I mean, I had Tom Stoppard there too, but it was, you know, and I remember he served two Chateauneuf du Papes, and I thought Chateauneuf du Pape was like my college date wine, and I thought it wasn't very serious because I don't know, it was just a wine that, you know, I used to order and impress girls in college, and I forgot about it. But he served two Chateauneufs, which at that time would have been about 20 years old, a 64 and a 67 Paul Jabalé Le Cèdre. And I thought, wow, this is great. And and also, besides Tom Stauber, Janice Robinson was at the table. So I met her. And she wears her learning very lightly, you know. And frankly, a lot of times she'd rather talk about books than wine, you know, or food or anything but wine. But of course, you know, most of us want to hear what she has to say. And so I learned a lot from these guys. But basically what I learned was the Rhone and Bordeaux. So when I started writing about wine, say 10 years later, I started exploring the new wine regions. Like, you know, I went to California. Not a new wine region, but it was to me. I went to Argentina. I went to Chile. I went to South Africa. So, you know, all along, I've been trying to find the new wine regions myself. And I mean, at this point, it's really hard to keep up. But it seemed like for a while in the 90s, you could keep up. But, you know, I get around.
But does it seem like over that same period of time that the idea of celebrity and wine became closer?
It certainly, yeah. It happened with chefs. About 15, 20 years ago, and it seems to be happening with sommeliers and winemakers, yeah, to a certain extent.
Because did you shift from going hanging out with fashion models to sommeliers? You're like, oh no, these are the new fashion models.
I definitely don't hang out with fashion models anymore. I spent a lot. I did that, and it was fun, but the conversations weren't very enlightening. And eventually, it's like, you know, vodka and cocaine don't really teach you much in the long run, but you know, wine is an endless subject, and it's a way of intellectualizing my hedonism, you know? I mean, I still had the buzz, but it was, you know, I'm a student and I'm, I don't want to sound pretentious, but I like to think I'm an intellectual and I like to study. And wine is an endless subject. You know, you can never, ever learn everything there is to know about wine. But, you know, you can approach wine too from so many angles. I mean, for me, one of the benefits that I have as a novelist is that I'm fairly adept at creating metaphors and similes and analogies. And to me, that's the only way that I can really convey the thrill and the impression that I get from a given wine. Because I don't know if I'm a super taster. I don't think I am. And also, I don't know that much about flowers. So, you know, you're never going to hear me say that something smells like hibiscus or some type of rose, because I just don't have that knowledge. And I think that, you know, exact descriptors can really trip us up sometimes, you know. I would rather go with a metaphor.
Driving through the desert of Vegas before the casino is like decanting the Cote Rôti, like that kind of thing, right? Because there's always an excitement when you do it. It seems like an adventure. Yeah. Like, don't Bogart that, Sancho. Is one of my favorite Jay comments, you know.
That old Rioja, huh? Yes, I remember that one. I really leaned heavily on the sort of models and actresses when I started writing about wine. You know, like Chablis is like Kate Moss, and the California Chardonnay is like Pamela Anderson, you know, I mean, that's the obvious kind of one. But, you know, going back 18 years now, let's say when Pamela Anderson was still a current name, if you said to someone, this wine is like Pamela Anderson, they kind of know what you mean, even if, you know, whereas if you said it's oaky and buttery, that might work too. But I think Pamela Anderson's more direct. Poems, pops, you know, songs. I mean,
yeah.
I've reached for a lot of these things because I think people can grasp a shared cultural reference sometimes more easily than they can a string of descriptors. You know, if you string together as wine critics often do, a whole bunch of flavors, you know, mocha and black currant and graphite and, you know, all these things that, you know, I feel like as a reader and a drinker, my head is spinning. God, I'll never forget who was. Somebody was trying to describe an Austrian Riesling, and I remember there was pebbles, minerals, boulders. It was like, but it's all fucking rocks, dude. It's like, you
know, watch out for those teeth. This could hurt.
I like everybody else, I resort to those flavor descriptors and those aroma descriptors as well. But I'm just not sure how useful they are for all the time for everyday readers.
But if I was making the kind of allusions that you make, I would find it harder with this era of generational change to figure out how to do that. Because I would be like, well, am I talking to boomers? Am I talking to X? Am I talking to millennials? Should I be listening to like the weekend
good
videos?
Point.
Or
yeah,
like, you know,
good.
Because I find it hard to keep up with what the kids like and, you know.
Well, yeah, I'm stuck with my own cultural references. But on the other hand, we do share a world of popular culture. Most of us, even if we're, you know, whether we're 25 or 60. I mean, I listen to a lot of the same, I watch a lot of the same TV and listen to a lot of the same music as my kids do. My kids are 20.
But do they watch movies? I found that's the big difference. When I make movie references, everyone's like, what? You mean in a theater? Like you went and saw that in the dark?
Yeah, well, they watch them on their computers.
You know, it seems like no one watches movies anymore. You're like, oh, really? You've never seen The Godfather? Really? Is that true? Really? Yeah?
Nah, surely The Godfather is still a common cultural
ask. I challenge you to leave this interview and ask a young person.
In my house it is, you know.
But. Yeah, you may like, all right, before dinner comes, I want you to tell me who was the bad dog.
And you know, Scarface is a big touchstone in hip-hop culture. Sure. So is The Godfather, I think. But you can't be entirely up to the minute when you're my age. I lean on what I consider timeless cultural references as I get older. Maybe I mean, you know, I describe Burgundy as being more Fitzgerald's to Bordeaux's Hemingway. You know, I mean, I like to think people are still aware of Fitzgerald and Hemingway, but maybe I'm being optimistic.
Well, I think a lot of people like that idea that they like kind of touch into that more literary side without really having to do the work by reading your thing. True. Being like, oh, I feel more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. He's using a Hemingway reference. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Now, I once get some nasty comment from a reader of the Wall Street Journal who wanted to know who her Turgenev was. So, and accused me of being an elitist. And I'm like, well, why not? You know, there's something too that's, you know, this raises the whole question of wine and elitism. And, you know, let's face it, it is a somewhat rarefied body of knowledge, of interest. And, you know, there are some people who just think that it's foppish to even pretend that there are differences between wines that we can discern and discuss. And, you know, I don't know, we just aren't going to have much to say to those people. We wish them well, but we don't want to have dinner with them, you know?
How much do the literary predecessors for you really still hang out in your head? I mean, you talked about Hemingway and Fitzgerald, but I mean, what about Mailer and Plimpton? I mean, what about the guys New York as the story?
Yeah, well, you know, I came to New York in 1980. And in 1982, George Plimpton published my first short story in the Paris Review. And I was lucky to, I mean, that was a great moment in my life. I never forget when he called up and I thought it was somebody pranking me. Oh, George Plimpton, yeah. And he claimed to like my story, and I'm not very good with imitations, but he wanted to publish it. And really, it was sort of rushed into print in a matter of months, which is quick for a literary journal. And I was invited, I started getting invited to his house, which was the last great literary salon in New York. He had a big townhouse on East 72nd, all the way on the river. And it was also the offices of the Paris Review. And you'd go there, and, you know, the first time I went there, I saw William Styron, Norman Mailer, Truman Capote. This was like his last year, I think. Robert Stone, Gay Talese, and all these beautiful young girls, too, which was always part of the scene at George's house. And we would, you know, they would subsequently take me to Elaine's. Not, you know, not a real touchstone for food and wine, but it was an incredible gathering spot for the, you know, the sort of literary entertainment elite of the 70s and the 80s. And I met a lot of these guys. I mean, I spent a lot of time with Mailer, Mailer actually showed up. First time I met Mailer, I think, was he showed up at my book party. I had a book party at Area, the nightclub. It's probably the first book party that was held at a nightclub. And Area was kind of the hot spot then. It was the spot. And along with Boy George and Sting, Mailer showed up. And that was pretty cool because, you know, it was sort of this generational sort of meeting of the generations. And he, you know, tacitly gave me his blessing. I don't know whether he had read the book at that point. But we subsequently became friends, and I spent a lot of time with him. And, you know, he was a great drinker. I mean, I don't think he was a very discriminating drinker. I don't think he ever thought much about wine, but of course, at the time, I wasn't thinking much about it either. Vodka was my fuel for a while.
But Mailer kind of grappled with being a man, right? I mean, part of his subject is how to be masculine, right?
He was very self. I don't want to say self-conscious about it. Yeah, that was a big. I think that was a big thing for him in his generation. You know, I think by the time my generation came along, I don't think we were that
interested in that question. You know, I mean, feminism just was something I absorbed and accepted. Mailer never did. You know, I found Mailer's whole his obsession with masculinity to be a little wearying in the end. You know, he partly inherited that from Hemingway, and I'm sure it was very tedious in Hemingway too. If one had known Hemingway. You know, all that arm wrestling. And in Norman's case, it was thumb wrestling. And so we used to have to thumb wrestle. I mean, Jesus, you know, aren't we adults here? But he, you know, he always had to be the alpha male. And I mean, in my case, it was easy to let him be the alpha male. You know, he was Norman Mailer, no problem. But I still had a great time with him, and I learned a lot from him. And I even got headbutted by him once, which was very exciting.
How did that go down?
Well, I mean, it was planned. He wanted to like headbutt and see who would, you know.
He was like, "Who's in for this?"
Yeah.
I got a fun party trick.
Yeah, but he was. I mean, he was certainly one of my mentors. My real mentor, though, was somebody who finally had to give up the liquid pursuit of pleasure. Raymond Carver, who was just apparently just a really, really bad drinker, and I met him just after he went on the wagon, but. As a writer, as a mentor, I learned as much from him as from anyone. And you know, I think he's one of the most important writers of the latter half of the 20th century, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, he sort of revived literary realism and the short story in much the same way that Hemingway did in the early part of the century. And I was lucky enough to study with him at Syracuse and spent a couple of years under his tutelage, and my first book, we ended up kind of touring together because he had a collection coming out. He was a great guy, and I miss him.
What was he like in person?
He was very gentle, and I mean, he was a big bear of a man. First time I met him, he came down to my apartment. My future editor and former Williams roommate Gary Fiskejohn had lunch with him and Gordon Lesh, And actually, Gary and I had been out all night the night before. And so I was sleeping when he called me after lunch. And he said, Raymond Carver is here and we have to go back to work and he doesn't know what to do. So I'm sending him to your apartment. I said, oh, yeah, sure. And I hung up. And then like 10 minutes later, the buzzer buzzes and there's this big hulking guy at my door. And we sat down and I just, you know, didn't know what to do. He sat down and we just started talking. We talked for about 4 hours. It was quite extraordinary. And then realized we were late for his reading up at Columbia and raced on the subway up to Columbia. And he could see that living in New York and staying up all night doing cocaine was not really conducive to my goal of becoming a writer. And he convinced me to, The reason we were late for the reading at Columbia is because we were blowing some lines. But
he did bumps with
yeah. So then we he encouraged me to come to Syracuse where he was teaching, and they said he might be able to get me a fellowship. And I mean, I don't know why he thought that I would be a good candidate, since at that time he didn't know anything about my writing. But that's what happened. I applied. He got me a fellowship and I moved to reluctantly moved to Syracuse, because you can imagine, you know, after 3-4 years in New York in the 80s, I did not really want to go to Syracuse, New York. But on the other hand, if I hadn't gone to Syracuse, I probably never would have written Bright Lights, Big City, which was about, you know, frittering my life away in the early 80s in New York.
But did that become like kind of a role for you that you had to play with other people? Like, hey, I'm the bon vivant of New York, but you know.
Well, yeah, definitely. It became a bit of a trap. And, you know, a bit of a, you know, as I said earlier, it was a persona that was based on certain aspects of my personality and my behavior, but it was kind of confining after a while, you know? I mean, I still, you know, I was kind of shocked. I picked up the New York Times. Pete Wells, on his way to thrashing Jonathan Waxman, talks about, you know, Jam, the revival of Jams, the great 80s restaurant. And he says, anybody who expects to see Jay McInerney in the men's room snorting, believing in marching powder, won't be disappointed. And I thought, wow, that's still my image 30 years later.
Had you been to jams?
I did go to jams, yeah.
Yeah.
I did. I remember jams. You know, not too clearly, but I went to jams. I remember I met Jonathan then, and it was kind of a cool place. You know, we picked restaurants then for their fashionability, really. You know, it's like anything by Brian and Keith McNally was cool.
Odeon's on the cover, right?
Odeon's on the cover of Brightlands Big City. I actually the lawyers at one point when the book was, you know, well on its way to print, they suddenly said, "God damn, we gotta get permission." They said, "This place, Odeon, is real." And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, you allege that people do drugs there." And I said, "Well, it's worse than that. It's on the cover." And they said, "Oh my God." They said, You gotta get permission for this." So I actually went down and met Keith McNally for the first time. I mean, I'd seen him around, but I'd never had any, you know, I was not someone that he was going to take notice of at that point. And so, you know, we now have a running joke that I say he owes me money and he says that I owe him money. But
what'd you tell him?
I explained that, you know, there was a couple of scenes set in a book and this people were doing some drugs in the bathroom. And he said, "I'm shocked." And I think he basically thought he was never going to hear about this book again. And so he just said, "Yeah, fine. You have my permission." And it was that, and that cover image became extremely iconic. You know, this guy standing with his back to us in front of the Odeon with the World Trade Towers looming in the background. You know, it's a very iconic image, I guess, at this point. In fact, you know, on September 11th, I was walking, you know, was walking to the East Village. I was actually walking over to Brett's apartment. And I started talking to somebody in the street. And she was covered in dust because she'd just come up from there. And she suddenly started crying. And I said, What is it? And she said, "Oh my God, I just thought of the cover of your book." And, you know, the towers had just come down. And, I mean, it's an odd aspect of the cover image now. But at the time, I think Keith McNally just thought, sure, who cares, whatever. But, you know, I like to claim that I put his kids through college. You know? I ate those various restaurants so many times. But.
What was the day after that book came out like for you? I mean, how did your life change?
Oh, I mean, it took a while. I mean, things happened slower then, you know, because there was no internet. And basically, I had been prepared for nothing. In other words, Jason Epstein, the editor-in-chief of Random House, took me out to lunch, and he basically said, "Look, you've written a really good book," but he said, "Kids your age don't read. The novel's dead. Don't expect much, you know, kid." And I'd worked at Random House for a while as a reader, you know, somebody who read unsolicited manuscripts. And I had friends who were writers, and I'd seen people publish books, and I'd seen that the world didn't change, and their lives didn't even change. So I wasn't expecting much, but it started to get frantic pretty quickly. There was a bidding war in Hollywood, and there was an early, the New York Review of Books did a huge review of it, like virtually on publication, which they almost never do. And then, I don't know, I was on the Today Show before I knew it. And then suddenly Mick Jagger's people were calling. They wanted me to do a profile of him. And yeah, my life changed pretty quickly. And it was exciting and overwhelming. And I'm sure I did a lot of stupid things that I would rather that I hadn't. And I said a lot of stupid things. And a lot of things were attributed to me that simply weren't true. I mean, I was spotted in all kinds of places with all kinds of people that I had never been to and never met. And it was interesting. And I discovered that waiters in restaurants would listen in on my conversations with people and call the papers. And that was pretty weird. And it didn't help that around that time I started dating Marla Hansen, who, I don't know if you remember her, but she was the slashed model. She, this woman who was attacked by the thugs hired by her landlords, who slashed her face with razor blades. And she became, you know, sort of a sensation and a tabloid fixture. And that added to the the frenzy, I guess. But as I say, wine was a nice escape from all of that.
Did it seem more grown up?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it seemed more grown up than vodka and cocaine, yeah. But I didn't want it to be too grown up, you know? I mean, I thought, and part of the problem with wine, you know, even today, is this sense among the civilians that it's this terribly stuffy, elitist, grown up, phony kind of preoccupation. And I always wanted to battle that notion, you know? I saw myself as a wine populist, as opposed to a wine elitist. You know, I mean, of course, I drink a little better now than I used to in those days. But I still, you know, to loop back to something we were saying earlier, I still really like to taste something, you know, from a new region that I've never tasted before that my sommelier is all excited about.
What does the literary world think of the wine writing? Do people from that world ever tell you?
Well, I think they finally noticed. I don't know. Well, you know, the worst thing they think is that, oh, he's just quit. He's quit writing fiction. And now, if for some reason, he's turned his energies to wine writing. And in fact, you know, I still devote more of my time to fiction than to wine writing. I did, however, spend 2 years writing a novel that I decided not to publish. So that kind of, it made for this long hiatus between my last novel and the next one, which is coming out this summer. I've done this twice. I actually did right after Bright Lights. I wrote a novel that I decided not to publish, and you know, and I'm glad actually. And it was my agent who first said to me, "Jay, I don't know about this one." And I thought about it for a while, and I said, "Yeah, you're right." And my editor said, "I don't think you've got the ending right." And finally, I said, "You know what? It's not the ending. It's just I don't think this worked." And I may go back to this book now that I've finished the current one, which I just handed in a couple months ago. You know, I like to think nothing's ever wasted. At the very least, I'll mine it for spare parts, you know.
Do you ever think about writing in the second person again?
I don't think I'd write a novel in the second person again. Partly because the success of Bright Lights almost precludes that. You know, it's like people would just accuse me of imitating myself. And also, it's hard. It's hard. It's very limiting. And, you know, I think I found the perfect sort of limited subject and time frame for writing a novel in second person. But there's a lot that you can't do with the second person. I mean, you're sort of wedded to a single consciousness. And you know, I don't think it works at length. You know, you just can't write a big panoramic social novel in the second person. But you know, stories, yeah. I'm actually working on a story in the second person right now.
Do you find that the audience responds differently? Do they feel like you're really telling them about them?
Well, it worked that time. Worked pretty damn well. You know, I was just in Burgundy, and I was at Becky Wasserman's house. And this English guy, who I guess is a wine importer, was at lunch, and about 2.5 hours into lunch, you know, he'd heard that I was a writer, and he heard I wrote about wine, and then somebody brought up my novels. He suddenly said, "Oh my God!" He said, "You wrote Bright Lights, Big City," and he seemed to think that it was a relatively obscure book, but he had just read it like 6 months before, and he was like absolutely rhapsodic, and I mean, he just couldn't stop talking about it, and I thought, wow. I mean, it's good to know that it can still pack a punch, and that it can still, you know, be an emotional experience for someone who's, well, he was my age, I guess, but he missed it the first time around, and I'm still really proud of that book. And there's a type of book that only people in their 20s can write. You know, I mean, you can only write that coming of age novel once, and you can only mine your own life for that type of experience once. And frankly, I think, you know, there's a certain attunement to the zeitgeist that belongs to young people. And you stop hearing a certain kind of hum of the universe when you get older. And, you know, I think my later books are probably better than Bright Lights, Big City, but I think that, you know, the book struck a chord that you know, made people talk about it as a generational novel.
Did you intend that from the beginning? Were you like, I'm going to write a generational novel?
Geez, no. I mean, I was hoping to get enough good reviews to get a teaching job somewhere or a newspaper job somewhere. I didn't remotely think it would be successful. I mean, it's another thing that Jason Epstein said to me is he said, you know, nobody wants to read about New York City. It's funny now because there have been so many New York novels, but there hadn't been one in quite a long time. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, Mailer and his generation, they weren't writing about, you know, even the guys who lived in New York, they weren't really writing about New York. I mean, Cheever wrote some stories about New York. But really since after Salinger, there wasn't that much New York fiction between Catcher in the Rye and Bright Lights, Big City. I mean, I can't think of any really, really successful or popular novels. So, you know, it's in the second person, it's set in New York, it's about a guy who works in New Yorker and wants to be a writer, and it didn't remotely seem like this was going to be of interest to a whole lot of people. It was a surprise to me when it was.
Jay McInerney, it's been a surprise, but it worked when it worked. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks, Libby.
Jay McInerney of Town and Country.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Scala has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's ILLDrinktothatPOD.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.